Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Oyan Mandel about the new book, A Stethoscope for the Brain, Preventive Approaches to Protect the Mind. Blending the stories of people affected by brain disease with the science that saves patients' lives, neuroscientist Oyan Mandel invites readers to learn about the future of brain health. Oyan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so can you tell us a bit more what you do?
Sure, so currently I am a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, and in tandem with that, I'm a neuroscientist. I got my PhD from the University of Cambridge before coming to medical school, and so I do neuroscience research and also interested in becoming a practicing physician.
And how did you get interested in this area?
Yeah, so I guess I was first interested in the brain. So, when I was in college, I read some books from Oliver Sacks. I think this is a way that a lot of people end up becoming interested in the brain. So Oliver Sacks is a neurologist who writes stories about his patients. And I was just so fascinated by how much you can learn about the brain and how we think by examining patients who have problems with the nervous system. And it was this like very unique combination of humanity and science. So I wanted to study the brain more and more, and I got involved in research. That led me into doing a PhD in neuroscience, and all throughout the way, I just really wanted to, be in the room with people who are dealing with neurological conditions. I felt like I got a lot of inspiration for that from them. So I pursued this sort of combined path of getting an MD as well and hopefully becoming a physician scientist one day.
That's quite an interesting, sort of not a shift, but addition to your research mindset, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think it synergizes very well. I mean, I was very much inspired by physician scientist mentors that I have had whose research questions were very much motivated by the patients they saw in clinic. And I just really wanted that for myself. And I found, even when I was doing my own PhD, academia ends up being somewhat of a silo at times. And so being able to, interact with people actually suffering from these conditions gives you a lot of really interesting ideas regarding what the next research questions should be and what research directions might be very beneficial for patients later down the line. So that's why I ended up taking the path I took.
And did you find it easy or difficult, this kind of transition, or were you very supported along your way?
It's not very easy. I mean, I feel like it's two very different mindsets, and you have to sort of switch between the two, especially like now, as I am still trying to finish up stuff from research during my PhD and now medical school on top of that. But it's always fulfilling and always stimulating. You're always thinking about something different. And it's just really nice. So I appreciate being stimulated all the time. And so it's been a good path for me.
And perhaps the obligatory question as well, what about the timelines? You know, you've done your PhD, obviously that took you a few years, and now medical school. What about this side of it?
Yeah, so my path ends up also being a bit unique because I did my PhD in the UK, where you can, in theory, do your PhD within 3 years because you start on your dissertation work immediately. So coming out of undergrad, I was still very much interested in medicine. I don't think I would have done my PhD at that point if I had done it in the US, where it would have taken maybe 6 or 8 years. So that's kind of how I made the timeline work for me. I decided to get it at a school where I knew that I could finish quickly if I wanted to, and to transition to medical training and get it all done in a reasonable time frame.
And from your experiences, what would you say to our student listeners and perhaps researchers that are also considering this kind of career path?
Yeah, I think just always stay curious. That's the number one thing. And read vociferously. I think that has been invaluable in terms of my research career, at least like how I sort of made myself known around the lab, was that I was always very up to date with the latest studies. I liked to go to journal clubs, lead journal clubs, stay really in touch with the research, not just within my field, but in other fields too. And I think what that helps you do is look for the translations between different fields. You know, oftentimes an advance in science is just taking a technique, a method that was used to discover something in one system and applying it to your own system and to your own questions. And you can learn a lot of very interesting things that way. So I think that's a recipe for success in research. It's definitely a recipe for success in medicine, where things are always constantly changing and you always have to learn. And for sure for writing, I mean, a lot of how I came up with stories to talk about for the book was just by reading very widely and just trying to connect the stories that already exist with emerging topics in neuroscience research.
So your latest book is A Stethoscope for the Brain: Preventive Approaches to Protect the Mind. And how did you get inspired? When did you decide that you wanted to write this book?
Yeah, so I decided to start writing this right after I had committed to a medical school. And so I had just spent all this time writing applications. And in my applications, I often say that, you know, I want this career as a public intellectual, as someone who writes for a public audience. And part of that was inspired by, like, in college, I had also written a column for my school newspaper. And I always wanted this to be a big part of my career. But I realized I hadn't really done much since undergrad in terms of advancing that side of myself. So I first started with the idea that, like, I wanted to write a book that was in somewhat of an Oliver Sacks style, combining patient stories with, latest advances in neuroscience research. And then it was like, in terms of settling on the exact idea of the book, Stethoscope for the Brain, and this focus on proactive approaches for brain conditions, that started to develop while I was in medical school and learning about all the ways in which physicians can diagnose and treat conditions before they ever manifest as symptoms that the patient experiences. And it just seems like, neurology didn't have as many examples of that type of phenomenon. And I also, thought more about my research and other people's research. And I think that it's, something that a lot of people are searching for, having better ways to diagnose brain conditions earlier and hopefully treat them earlier.
And so let's dive in. And can I start with you maybe describing of where did you find yourself as an undergrad and in university? What kind of questions did you have about the brain?
Yeah, so I began college as a linguistics major, actually. I was very interested in the notion that, language could have a physical basis to it. So it's like there's interactions between cells and molecules could somehow result in speech and comprehension. And so yeah, so I, at first I thought the best way of studying that was to study language itself. And in addition, I worked in a neuroscience lab. I worked in a lab that studied patients with aphasia, and these are patients who've had damage to their brain such that they have deficits in language, deficits in either speaking or comprehending speech. I got really interested in that sort of connection between brain and mind, and it just led me to becoming more interested in the neuroscience behind several different cognitive functions. It started off with language, but now has transitioned to studying other things, other diseases of the brain.
So many of our listeners would ask, you study the brain, of course, you know people who are developing these disorders. Is that the way that research actually works nowadays?
In terms of studying patients who have brain disease as like a way of understanding the brain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's at least one area of neuroscience to investigate patient populations who have a certain condition and trying to learn more about how that brain function operates normally by studying people who don't have it. That's one segment of neuroscience research. I'd say there's a lot of different questions you can ask. Studies of patients can be quite limited, obviously, for ethical considerations. It's hard to do, actual experiments that are very invasive in people. So a lot of neuroscience research, will involve animal models, will involve circumstances where performing experiments might be more ethical and acceptable. There's a lot to learn, I think, from studying patients. In particular, the word that's sometimes used is natural experiments. So when people have strokes in certain areas of the brain, that presents like an opportunity to study what the functions of those brain regions are in a way where you haven't manipulated anything, but just based on how disease patterns and how they manifest, it allows you to study certain ask and answer certain questions.
And then when we think about more basic research, when it comes to molecular sciences, how do we translate it to the patients? How are these two fields sort of coinciding?
Yeah, I mean, it's a constant question. And I think what's unfortunate is that not enough of it happens, at least how the pipeline that seems to potentially work and can translate between these things is this pipeline that first involves, it's more applicable to conditions that are in some way genetically mediated. So let's take like schizophrenia, for instance. This is a disorder that's pretty highly heritable. One sort of strategy to translating between patients and the wet lab and vice versa is to understand genes which seem to be associated with a brain disease like schizophrenia. And then once we understand what those genes are, we can go to the wet lab and start figuring out what the functions of those genes actually are for the brain. We can start trying to introduce those specific genetic mutations or phenotypes into animals and start understanding a bit about how these genetic mutations affect behavior that way. And then we can find, better therapies and tools to reverse whatever those, genetic risk factors are doing in the animal model and turn that into a therapy that we then introduce to patients. So that's, it doesn't always work exactly that way, but that's the general idea of how we can sort of one way in which we can flip back and forth between, the patient studies and the animal models and vice versa. But that's just one example. And I think it's a huge challenge and something we're still trying to work on.
So now circling back to the title of your book, Stethoscope for the Brain, can you describe how did you come to this title and what does it mean?
Yeah, so stethoscope for the brain. So I guess I'll start with what I think it means. A very amazing and underrated thing happens when you go to the doctor's office. So a physician's able to take your blood pressure And this ends up being a measure of your cardiovascular health, ends up being pretty predictive of various different types of bad things that can happen to your heart. And if you keep this blood pressure measurement low, that's, prognosticates pretty well for you that you're not going to have significant health problems. At least it's a good marker that it's not going, that's not going to happen. So, and where stethoscope comes in is that a stethoscope is an instrument that is used in the measurement of a blood pressure. So that idea of having, not necessarily a symptom, a problem that a patient has, having a high blood pressure is sometimes called the silent killer because you don't have any symptoms from it. But knowing that you have a high blood pressure gives you an indication that something is wrong with your heart, and you can then start to take preventive measures to stop you from having any actual symptoms of heart disease. And the question really is, how can we develop tools like that for the brain? How can we develop a stethoscope for the brain, something that allows us to non-invasively but proactively assess brain health so that we can make changes before irreversible brain damage occurs?
Oh, I really hope that this could be a possibility in the near future. So can we start with a few things that can go wrong with the brain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of things can go wrong with the brain, unfortunately. I think one thing that I talk a lot about in the book, I think it's top of mind for many listeners and for many people in general, is dementia and neurodegeneration. So just through the normal aging process, along with some biological processes that we're still learning more and more about, you can get an accumulation of bad proteins in the brain, and these can cause very significant damage. When they cause enough damage, you get what people call dementia, and the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. So memory impairments or other types of cognitive impairments that result from too much of these bad proteins accumulating in the brain. The tricky thing with it is that we now have very good evidence that a lot of this underlying pathology, a lot of this sort of accumulation of bad proteins is happening well before people experience any symptoms. And by the time that people have significant symptoms from these types of conditions, have a, observable dementia, a lot of damage might have already been done. So that's sort of what hints at, the purpose of this book to start catching these problems earlier. But it's a very prevalent problem across the world, especially as we are an aging population, and the fact that aging is the number one risk factor for having dementia. I'd say that's top of mind for me and top of mind for a lot of people.
So this has been studied for well over a century, hasn't it?
Yeah.
What is your perspective on our progress? How are we approaching it?
Yeah, so I think progress has, there are stories that people tell and there are stories that people don't tell, I think, with respect to all of this. A lot of the conversation has surrounded how can we, which are the exact proteins that are involved, so there's amyloid beta and there's tau protein, and we know that both are associated, which is playing the bigger role. We've made a lot of progress in terms of unraveling this story and trying to figure out who the major players are. And, like I was saying before, a big sort of helpful thing in disentangling these types of questions is the genetics. So we know of various genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, and that's given us some clues into the pathophysiology of it all. As I'm sure many of your listeners might be familiar with, we've tried targeting these bad proteins, specifically amyloid, quite a lot. We've had limited success in that domain. There was a drug that very recently came out that has promise. So far, there's only been a press release about it saying that it leads to better clinical outcomes. And then there was another drug that has been approved by the FDA, but there's this whole controversy surrounding that that I won't get into right now. That's a long way of saying we're developing, we're starting to get to a place where we have therapies, but they're still in this experimental stage. The hope is that we can start rolling those out and that they'll be shown and established very convincingly to be effective. And then that will be a huge milestone in our centuries-long fight against dementia, for sure.
And then touching up on a second part of the title of your book, the preventive approaches. So when it comes to the long-term neurodegeneration that could result in dementia, what kind of preventive approaches are or have been proven, maybe stave off the progression?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a good amount of work showing that, you know, the same things that keep your heart healthy are very good for keeping your brain healthy. So exercise has been shown to, reduce your risk of dementia quite substantially. Eating a Mediterranean diet is something that people like point to a lot as being effective for, preventing dementia. Something I go into a little bit of detail about in the book is this notion of, early childhood education and just education throughout your life in terms of keeping your mind stimulated. The thought process here is that, so on the one hand, we have this pathology happening, this accumulation of amyloid beta that's damaging your brain. But, what most people care about is not necessarily, do I have bad proteins in my brain, but rather, am I able to still function at, my normal level? And it turns out that if we can keep our minds stimulated, if we can keep ourselves healthy, we can, live without having dementia, even if this underlying pathology is happening in our brain. And so this is a notion called cognitive reserve. And we find that it can be enhanced by things like lifelong bilingualism, using two different languages or multiple languages throughout your life. Keeping up with playing an instrument, social engagement is a very big one. So social isolation has been associated with a 50% increased risk of dementia. And so we don't think of talking to people as a very cognitively stimulating activity, but it actually is to carry on a conversation. It's something that really challenges your mind. And, unfortunately, a lot of elderly people don't get a lot of social engagement. So ways in which we can keep our sort of brain circuits, our brain stimulated and energized, there's a lot of good evidence showing that this can be very effective at preventing dementia. If we had drugs that had the same effect sizes of what these types of interventions have been able to do for the brain, I think that, whatever companies developed drugs with that level of effectiveness would be very rich right now. So I think it's a very, underappreciated way of protecting your brain, just staying healthy and staying cognitively engaged.
I'm really glad that you started on this topic of the cognitive reserve, and especially thinking about some of the individuals that can be called resilient, that can build up a huge amounts of these sort of quote unquote bad proteins, but they can still function well into their old age without the signs of dementia itself. So can you maybe describe a couple of studies that have been conducted on these individuals?
Yeah, so at least the study I talk about in the book is, it's called the Nunn study. It's a very clever one, because in all these types of questions and experiments that we're talking about, which involve relating something like early childhood education with prevention from dementia, you run into this problem of confounding variables. So you might imagine that there are a ton of different things associated with having early childhood education, like being of a higher socioeconomic status, having better health maintenance, and all these different things that could also, be what's actually related with being protected from dementia. But to sort of isolate out that one variable of education, takes a lot of statistical work and might not necessarily be valid. So what the nun study did that was very clever is they took a population of Catholic nuns who all live very similar lifestyles. You know, they have the same access to healthcare. They eat more or less the same things. They're similar on a number of different levels. The one difference is really like what they did before they joined the convents, the place where the nuns live. And that they're able, with that type of experimental design, sort of free from most confounding variables, they're able to show this association between, in particular, early linguistic ability or generating a lot of ideas in your speech. And that has an association with education too. That was shown to be common amongst these nuns who never had dementia. Mm. So that's the main study that I have in mind. A number of subsequent studies have been done since then, hopefully trying to find like the neural substrate of cognitive reserve. That's been a bit less successful, but people have been able to show that things like social engagement is associated with, or not as much reduction in the volume of your hippocampus or other structures in the brain that are associated with dementia. So it's been a pretty exciting field, but something that I don't think gets as much press as it should.
So now thinking about the factors that can lead to brain disorders from the outside, so more like trauma. So what do we know about these kinds of disorders and how do we prevent them?
Yeah, so head trauma is an interesting one because how I'd classify it is that we have like two types of head trauma. You have like an injury to your head that can basically result in bleeding into your brain. And that type of head trauma, the result of it is something that we can, we have a stethoscope for that. We have brain imaging and it's an ability, and it's a tool that allows us to figure out that type of problem is happening and allows us to resolve it and treat it. Now there's more conversation about the sort of invisible head traumas. So repeated injuries to the head that might cause concussions. So cognitive states that where you might be having a bad headache and you might sort of be afraid or negatively impacted by light and all these other symptoms associated with having a concussion. Having lots of those isn't very good for your brain, obviously. And there are also subconcussive impacts. So injuries to your head, but something that you don't necessarily notice. Mm-hmm. Now, those types of head injuries that don't result in something that you can visualize if you scan the brain, those are being associated now with what's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a type of dementia that we still don't really know very much about. And especially there's been a big conversation about this type of medical disorder happening to former American football players. I think that we have some tools to identify and treat, certain types of brain disorders or head traumas that result in, gross findings. But in terms of understanding these head injuries that lead to more minor and microscopic changes that might nevertheless affect brain function in the long term, that's something that's still not known. Now, in terms of preventing these things, the sort of obvious idea could be to, not do these sports or not pursue these occupations that are associated with recurrent head trauma. But I think there's also, with everything in medicine, there's got to be this balance between your hobbies and what you really enjoy doing and get a lot of joy, derive a lot of meaning from, with the activities that we know are healthy. So nobody wants to live like a perfectly healthy life. I think that we all have our guilty pleasures. We all life wouldn't be worth living unless there was something to live for. I think it's still a challenge to sort of grapple between, that desire to live how you want to with also wanting to be as healthy as possible. And I think that just if we had more tools to better detect and understand those subconcussive head injuries and monitor how much of them we're having and whether it's something that we need to be worried about or not, that's just going to help people make better and more informed decisions.
So now we've been talking about more endogenous and exogenous causes, quote unquote, because we don't really know down to molecular level of how the brain goes wrong. So of course, in medicine and in life, nothing is in vacuum. So there's always plenty of interactions. And what do we know from this side of the coin, perhaps the intermingling of genetics and environmental factors?
Sorry, could you phrase the question again?
So what do we know about the intermingling of the environmental factors and genetics of the individual and their susceptibility to develop brain disorders, for example?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's very different depending on like which disorder we're talking about. They're all very, very different and have distinct etiologies. I think that for disorders like stroke, for ALS, for brain tumors, for head trauma, I guess you could put in that category too. There's unfortunately like not much that is very predictive of whether you're going to have certain types of brain problems. Like having a brain tumor, for instance, there are very few predictive risk factors for whether or not you're going to have this. And the only environmental factor that we have to work with is exposure to radiation. That's the only thing that's really been robustly shown to be associated with having a brain tumor. So for some of these, there isn't a lot to go off of from the genetics. For some more of these, there is some stuff to go off of by the environmental factors, or at least things that happen after you're born. So for stroke, we have hypertension or having a high blood pressure is associated with having a stroke. And so having healthy living habits can prevent us from some of these too. But that's why I think we need sort of protection on multiple levels with these types of conditions. So we need to also be thinking proactively, not just in terms of preventing, strokes and things that we can predict, but also how can we also be thinking proactively when we're considering a condition like a brain tumor that has a high likelihood of progressing. So I think it's going to be a different answer depending on which condition that we're honing in on, because they all have very distinct etiologies.
And thinking about the environmental reasons for developing some of the psychiatric disorders. So do we know a lot about the pollutants, like air pollution, for example, or heavy metals, or pesticides and stuff like this? Like, how can this influence our susceptibility in developing some of these disorders?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. So in terms of like that specific question with environmental factors, I think that like lead paint is something that's associated with all types of bad things for your brain. But where I think that the conversation gets really interesting and what I talk a little bit about the book is this concept of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs is sometimes what people call them. So having like bad things happen to you as a child, things like, your parents consistently hit you, or, one of your caretakers went to jail, these types of adverse childhood experiences. If you accumulate enough of these, greater than four, it's associated with a very substantial raised risk for depression and for many other psychiatric conditions affecting the brain. That in addition to physical health disorders as well. So the study that was published on this showed an association between adverse childhood experiences and a wide range of poor health outcomes. And I think that's very interesting and important to keep in mind when writing a book, when talking about the preventive neurology and preventive neuroscience. It's that we think that a lot of the progress is going to happen with like more fancy tools and with new sort of advanced therapies. But oftentimes I think that what we need is really a true public health response and something that addresses the social determinants of health, because like these things can be like just as associated with future brain pathology as all the biomarkers that we hope to find and hope are going to be successful.
That's an excellent point, that we really need to look beyond the individual on a societal level when we want to address these kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Yeah, and many of our listeners perhaps also heard about many of the big brain projects that have been around in the world. Why do you think these haven't been as successful as they were purported to be to address these kind of disorders?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of major projects. I would push back on them not being successful. I think that there's like still a lot more to learn. So at least like one thing that I would call like a very big project that I think has led to a lot of really important insights is the UK Biobank project that has recruited like a pretty good segment of the population of the United Kingdom and has collected all types of very interesting data relating to the brain and relating to physical health and has put a lot of these different things together to come up with like very interesting epidemiological data that is actionable. So for instance, like they had a study recently that I would have loved to include in the book, but, I'd already sent it off, showing this association between, how many steps you take in a day and the association between that and risk for dementia, showing that if you take, and I think the number was around 10,000 steps a day, that it dramatically reduces your risk of having dementia. So I think there are some like, large scale projects that have been, very good and very helpful and have taught us a lot. There have been others that have been less successful. And I think that the issue sometimes is like, it has to be very clear what the goals are, right? And so I think that, for instance, when we're talking about things like developing a wiring diagram for the brain or connectomics, which is my area of research, I think that sometimes there needs to be a sense of like, what are you going to do once you have that tool available to you and how is it going to translate to patient care? Sometimes you don't know, and that's the point of doing the science and doing the work to discover things you don't know currently. But what I thought was really important and good about this book is that I think it provides a roadmap for what we can do. Many people see the brain as like a black box that we're not going to be able to crack, that we don't know a lot about. And, in large part that's true, but I think we also have a model from other areas of medicine like cardiology that have developed a lot of new treatments and a lot of new and innovative ways to treat the heart. And I think neurology has a lot to learn from these disciplines. And if we take the model of better understanding, predictors of disease and learning how we can modify those, I think that's a recipe for success.
So what directions in neurology nowadays really excite you?
Yeah, so one thing I talk about the book that really excites me is, work on multiple sclerosis and its association with the Epstein-Barr virus. So multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune condition. It's the most common cause of disability in young adults. And there's a study published just this year in 2022 presenting pretty good evidence that a virus called the Epstein-Barr virus is a plays a causative role in multiple sclerosis. Now, it's the case that like many, many people, I think like 90% of the adult population gets infected with multiple sclerosis, with Epstein-Barr virus at some point, and only a minority of these people end up getting multiple sclerosis, obviously. If you have Epstein-Barr virus, that seems to be a necessary condition for almost a necessary condition for developing multiple sclerosis. And that's really interesting because we can develop vaccines against viruses. Obviously with COVID, we've developed a pretty good vaccine against it. And that gives us now a really neat target for maybe like eradicating multiple sclerosis from the planet. I mean, it's a big goal, a lofty goal. It's something that I don't want to make any promises about, but, you know, in the same way that we were able to, you know, virtually eradicate polio by developing a vaccine against the poliovirus, you know, maybe one day we'll see that for multiple sclerosis. It would be, I don't want to sort of hype it up too much because I'm sure I'm not an expert in the field and I'm sure there are many barriers to getting there, but I think that's really exciting to think about, like, you know, really reducing the incidence of some of these diseases at a global scale by just like a simple vaccine, the same way that we've been able to limit the burden of several different illnesses.
That study is really fascinating, isn't it? And the way they approached it to get such a huge number of samples that were collected over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's almost like a theme of the book, it seems like. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate these like very large scale and like innovative epidemiological studies that provide like, you know, very actionable insights and things that we can actually do. And it was something that was planned over 20 years. And sometimes that's what it takes to come to a very, you know, interesting and important result, but we're better off for it.
So then where do we find ourselves nowadays? So of course, we can be talking about the wishful thinking about treating diseases at a very, well, near future, but not all of them will be treated in near future, will they?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that, and that's again, why we need sort of defenses on multiple fronts. I think that we need, you know, it would be, you know, fool's errand to think just about preventing disease and not about, you know, treating the diseases that already exist. I think that no matter what preventive approaches exist in the future, there's always going to be people who get extremely sick, even though they've done all the right things, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need a combination of, you know, better things we can do for people who are currently sick, but always have an eye towards how we're going to prevent diseases going forward.
Yeah, and perhaps also the aspect that you even started with, you know, including more patients in the research and have these conversations within and between the fields, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's invaluable with this type of work. I think that, and then the collaboration between disciplines, I think that's been what I've really appreciated by just being in this unique situation where I am a neuroscientist and also a medical student. Oftentimes in research, we get stuck in silos, but do things like reading books and writing books. I think that public engagement is something that just exposes you to a lot of really interesting ideas and allows you to make unique connections and new unique insights that inspire, you know, breakthroughs in the field, hopefully.
So now thinking about more of a bigger picture, what next steps do you foresee that we as a society should take to maybe be nearing this goal of having a good brain health on the level of society?
Yeah, so I think that number one is, might sound kind of boring because it's a little obvious, but because, you know, a lot of the book we've highlighted all of these sort of social public health factors that social determinants of health that relate to bad outcomes for the brain. And I think that, you know, this is something that we already know is the case. This is something that is strongly associated, not just with brain disease, but heart disease and all these things. I think the first step is to just expand or improve healthcare access to more people and encourage healthy living across more people. And that's gonna do a whole lot of good, not just for the brain, but for a lot of different health, organ systems. But then sort of second to that, in terms of like what we can really like have our hands on as like neuroscientists is, you know, thinking more about how our work could translate to making a difference for patients. Now, obviously, like how science works isn't you come up with very insightful realizations by doing something that you might think is totally unrelated to human health, and like CRISPR and how CRISPR was identified is a good example of that. But I think that well, you know, when you talk about the failures of some of these very large scale projects, I think that the way to sort of help yourself not fail is if you have in mind like how your work's going to really transform people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I hope to do with this book was just present sort of one way of doing it. And that means getting a better sense of how we can diagnose these conditions earlier. How can we get a better sense of like classifying and dissecting the heterogeneity of these conditions, because the main reason why a lot of our clinical trials fail to find new treatments is because we're treating something as if it's one disorder, but it might be multiple. Just trying to get a better getting a better handle of how to diagnose these things in the first place and to diagnose them accurately, I think that's the first step before we can start, hopefully the last step and the ultimate step is to develop better therapies. But I think that something that a lot of people in neuroscience have, realized, and I'm glad a lot of attention is going towards it. We also just need to understand these conditions better at a basic level before we design, clinical trials that are going to be effective.
And what discoveries in your research for your book, A Stethoscope for the Brain, surprised you the most?
Yeah, I think the big one is that, so on the one hand, Alzheimer's disease has, or dementia has been increasing in prevalence, over the years, right? Because we're an aging population. And so more people are getting dementia because of that. But we've actually done a better job at reducing the risk of dementia over time. So if we adjust for the fact that people are older now than they were 10 or 20 years ago, less people have dementia if we correct for the age differences. And so why is that? So it's because people are taking care of their heart a lot better than they were before. So we have all these new therapies to control blood pressure. We have these, more guidance about how to eat healthily and live healthily. And by protecting our heart health, we also protect our brain health via several factors that I discuss in the book. People have more access to education now than they did before. More people are going to school. We've made several advances as a society, is what I'm saying. And that has, translated into a measurable reduced risk for having dementia. And I think that's something that I did not know at all before doing this book. I think that there's sort of this bad news bias that oftentimes happens in all types of media, and I think science media too, in journalism, the phrase is, if it bleeds, it leads. So I think that we don't always talk enough about the successes we've made as a society, but I think they're also important to highlight because it's, inspires the idea that we can make progress and we should continue to make progress. So it's easy to feel hopeless sometimes in the face of like how devastating these conditions can be. But I think that I take a lot of solace in knowing that we're moving in the right direction in some ways.
And you yourself knowing so much about brain health, so what do you do to protect it? Or do you have any guilty pleasures that can be deemed unhealthy?
Yeah, so some of my loved ones like make fun of me a lot because I'm, supposedly this preventive medicine guy, but I don't always live up to that. I mean, I do try to exercise regularly. I try to walk regularly. I try to eat healthily. My big thing is that I do eat a lot of red meat, and that's probably not good for you. But that's sort of my guilty pleasure. Otherwise, like I don't eat a lot of sweet things. And I try to lead a somewhat active and mentally stimulating lifestyle. So hopefully that protects me, but you know, and it doesn't work for everyone. And we have to be sort of safe. And I think it's important to also, you know, live your life and enjoy the time that you do have. I think it'd be too stressful to sort of think like about how to live as healthily as possible all the time. I think it's okay to have one or two guilty pleasures.
No, for sure. Small steps, but maybe binge some trash TV now and then.
Oh, of course.
Well, this has been a truly insightful discussion. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Yeah, so for the first thing is I have to pass and get through medical school. So in January, I start my clinical rotations, which is a very busy time. And so unfortunately, I think I'll have to put down the pen for a little bit, but I hope to gather a lot of, you know, new insights from working in a hospital that could inform my next project. Part of me wants to like already even do like a second edition of this book, because as I've alluded to in this conversation, there's just been so much progress even since I sent it out to publishers. So I think like that would be a neat thing to do. Otherwise, I've also have an interest in physician mental health, especially after COVID-19 and the burden that, you know, all of us as a society have been through, but I think especially healthcare workers in terms of caring for, you know, a very sick population. I think that there are going to be, you know, downstream effects from all of that. And it's something that I'm interested in learning more about and potentially writing about, but we'll see how that might fit into my my schedule for clinical training first.
And what's the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Yeah, so the easiest thing to do is to go on Amazon and search A Stethoscope for the Brain. That's probably going to be the most reliable place to find it, a copy of it. Otherwise, more information about me can be found just by Googling my name.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.